Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast on heart failure and chronic kidney disease. This is the first podcast in our cardiorenal metabolic syndrome course. My name is Sam Robinson. I'm a GP and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. Today I will be talking to Professor Ahmet Fuat. Ahmet is a GP partner in County Durham with an extended role in cardiology. He is the current education and research lead of the Primary Care Cardiovascular Society, having been the immediate past president. He is the cardiovascular disease clinical advisor to the RCGP, heart failure lead clinician for the Northeast and North Cumbria Cardiac Network, and an honorary professor at Durham University. He is also on the editorial boards for both the Primary Care Cardiovascular Journal and the British Journal of Cardiology. Hi, Ahmet, and thank you for your time today.
Hi, Sam. Thanks very much. And it's a pleasure to join you.
Brilliant. Let's start this podcast by talking about heart failure, an area I know you're passionate about. Recently, when discussing heart failure, I've been hearing a lot about HFpEF versus HFrEF. Could you tell us what these acronyms stands for and what the differences are between the two, please?
Of course, yes. I think we've moved on from the old definitions that we used to have in medical school, didn't we, with biventricular failure, congestive heart failure, etc. So HFrEF stands for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, and HFpEF stands for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. If we look at the European Society guidelines, they also have heart failure with mildly reduced ejection fraction in there. And basically, the definition is all around left ventricular ejection fraction. So we consider over 50% normal ejection fraction. Both NICE and European Society guidelines suggest that HFrEF is an ejection fraction of 40% or less. HFpEF is ejection fraction of over 50%, but obviously with signs and symptoms and various other parameters that help us to then make that diagnosis. And mildly reduced is 41 to 49%. And we can perhaps discuss how we manage those later. So HFrEF is what we used to call left ventricular systolic dysfunction. It still is. It's where the left ventricle is often dilated, damaged, with reduced pumping or systolic function. It's often younger male patients with ischemia and inherited cardiomyopathies are examples. HFpEF is where there's a reduced filling ability of the heart, so diastolic impairment, so the filling of the heart is impaired. And this is often in older female patients with hypertension, atrial fibrillation, and other comorbidities. And it can be a difficult diagnosis to make.
Brilliant. That's really interesting and really helpful to know the different characteristics of the patients that it may come about in. I think we're familiar with the signs and symptoms of HFrEF, but should we be looking out for anything different in those with HFpEF?
Well, to be honest, Sam, it's almost impossible to differentiate just on symptoms and signs alone. And this is why NICE and every other guideline states that if we as GPs or anyone else, nurse practitioner, clinical pharmacist, secondary care physicians, suspect heart failure based on symptoms and signs, which are usually shortness of breath on exertion, reduced exercise tolerance, peripheral edema, sometimes orthopnea, so patients get short of breath when they lie flat in bed, or wake up in the night gasping for breath, coughing up classically pink frothy sputum, which we call paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, then these are potential signs of heart failure. And all those patients should be referred for a specialist assessment in echocardiography. The most important test is NT-proBNP. And again, this is in NICE guidelines. So it's a very good test for basically ruling out heart failure. So if the NT-proBNP is less than 400, according to NICE, then heart failure, whether it be HFrEF or HFpEF or mildly reduced, is very unlikely. And we should look for another cause. If it's over 400, they should all be referred for assessment and echocardiography. And only by doing that can we then decide whether they have heart failure or not, and which of the three categories we've talked about it fits into.
Oh, that's great. That's really helpful. And with the NT-proBNP, that's something that we can obviously do in primary care and then use the NICE guidelines to decide which pathway we need to go through.
Absolutely. And in a recent survey that we did with a patient organization called Pumping Marvelous, who are fabulous heart failure charity, patient charity, we found that over 90% of areas in the UK now have BNP or NT-proBNP available to GPs. I mean, it's amazing we don't have it, because we should, because, you know, it is such a good test. So we should have it available. We should look for symptoms and signs of heart failure and then do an NT-proBNP to then guide our further management and referral.
Great, that's really, really helpful. And certainly talking about the differences between HFrEF and HFpEF has been helpful and something that I will be more mindful of. Do you think there are barriers, other than not being aware maybe of the different types of heart failure, to the recognition and management of this condition?
Absolutely. I mean, I did my PhD in heart failure, and the first paper I ever published was the barriers to diagnosis and management of heart failure across primary and secondary care. And we then repeated this qualitative study 10 years later, and sadly, nothing much had changed. So the main three barriers are physician related. So understanding, trying to recognize the symptoms and signs and going on to investigate. Patient barriers. So patients often just assume their reduced exercise tolerance, their fatigue is age related, and don't come forward to see us. And organizational factors. So not having dedicated heart failure clinics with expedient access, not having open access echocardiography, some areas still not offering NT-proBNP. So these are a lot of those barriers. One of the big barriers to primary care, of course, is that, you know, our workload is huge. You as and I have seen it over years, me many more years than you, Sam. But, you know, we manage so many other things, but we need to be aware of subtle symptoms and signs of heart failure, because often we get unfairly criticized by secondary care for not recognizing it, but it often presents to us very early with very subtle edema, exercise intolerance, et cetera. So what I would encourage people to do is what we do in our long-term conditions clinics is patients who are more likely to get heart failure, so existing ischemic heart disease or coronary heart disease, diabetes, especially type 2, hypertension, atrial fibrillation, previous stroke, CKD, they're all more likely to get heart failure. So when we review these patients, we actually ask direct questions about peripheral edema, about shortness of breath on exertion, orthopnea, PND, etc. And if they do have those symptoms, we do NT-proBNP. Mm-hmm. And in my own practice of 11,000 patients, our heart failure prevalence is 3.1%. The national prevalence is 0.9%.
Wow.
So I think we're missing a lot because we're not asking the right questions, not diagnosing it. So that is one of the reasons why we should be more aware of it. And of those, 60% are HFrEF and 40% are HFpEF. And we've just recently audited that in my practice where we've got 330 patients with heart failure.
Wow, that's quite a lot actually. More HFpEF than I was expecting, and really kind of brings home that it's important to look out for those symptoms.
Well, interestingly, that's exactly what most of the epidemiological studies say now, that if you break down heart failure, around 60 to 66%, so around two-thirds are HFrEF and a third are HFpEF. And the HFpEF is not often recognized or diagnosed. It can be a very difficult condition to diagnose because, with all due respect, none of us as GPs, except the odd people like me and people who've maybe worked in cardiology, it's difficult to interpret what is diastolic impairment, what these measurements are, left atrial size, etc. So there are specific criteria that point to HFpEF or help diagnose HFpEF. So that signs and symptoms, raised NT-proBNP, evidence of diastolic impairment on an echo, and there are different ways of diagnosing that. And I think many of these should be referred to heart failure clinics for a diagnosis.
Absolutely. And I think talking about the long-term condition clinics as well is really brings home how much the cardiorenal metabolic syndrome really overlaps with each other and the importance of being aware of that. And mentioning those patients, I've certainly had patients who have come breathless and they've just assumed that it's because they're not as fit as they used to be, or it's just their COPD getting a little bit worse, and actually it may not be. So it's really helpful and interesting to bring that to the front of my mind.
And you've just highlighted that I forgot one group, which is COPD. So thank you. Yeah, we asked them too. That's a really difficult group, isn't it? Because they often have some shortness of breath, fatigue. And, you know, there have been various studies done. A Dutch colleague of mine, Anton Mostard, and colleagues did a NT-proBNP and then echo study of COPD patients and found that up to 40% had unrecognized HFrEF of varying degrees.
Right,
and
gosh.
Then if they're treated, many of them will then benefit from the drugs we use for HFrEF. So we shouldn't just assume it's because of their COPD.
Great, yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's certainly, having looked at this topic, it's something I'm more aware of now than previously. So what can we do in primary care, and when should we be referring on?
Well, I guess we've discussed some of that before. And I mean, I think it's probably quite nice to take a step back and remember that we should also practice prevention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think it is the role of primary care to identify and appropriately treat those conditions that can lead to heart failure. And so things like hypertension, which I'm afraid we often don't diagnose properly, and we often don't get to target. And sadly, the last year we've seen, you know, 20 to 30% less blood pressure checks, and 20% less patients getting to target. So things like that, diagnosing atrial fibrillation, but then managing these with lifestyle, exercise advice, smoking cessation, dietary advice, alcohol. So let's not forget that we can prevent heart failure by managing hypertension, diabetes, CKD, atrial fibrillation, obesity, et cetera, better. And the other thing I think is, which I mentioned before, be on the lookout, be aware of symptoms and signs of heart failure, have a lower threshold for asking those questions and ordering NT-proBNP in those groups of patients we've already mentioned, and use NT-proBNP. It's a simple test that most of us can get. And if it's raised, they may have heart failure, they may not, because other things can raise it. It does go up with age, and some areas use age-related cutoffs, but that's not what NICE says. We use age-related. But also things like atrial fibrillation, left ventricular hypertrophy, severe COPD, renal disease, CKD4-5, liver disease can all raise NT-proBNP. So don't tell the patient you've got raised NT-proBNP, you've definitely got heart failure, because they may not, but they need investigation.
Great, and I think that brings us nicely to my next section. Certainly from what we've talked about, it's given me a lot to think about. And I just wondered if we can now talk a little bit more actually about kidney disease. We know that cardiorenal metabolic syndrome means that systems such as the cardiovascular system, the renal system, and diabetes interconnect. So how does chronic and acute kidney disease factor into this? And how should we be managing acute kidney injury, or AKI, as we often call it now?
So, I think the first thing to say is that there is a huge interconnectivity. Lots of theories around why that is. One system that does tie everything together is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, so the RASi system, because, angiotensin, aldosterone, renin, all lead to adverse cardiovascular, metabolic, and renal symptoms. And two-thirds of our HEF-REF patients in particular have CKD. Many patients with type 2 diabetes develop heart failure within 5 years of diagnosis, and these are often undiagnosed. And various different studies have shown anything up to 68% of type 2 diabetics get some objective evidence of heart failure within 5 years. 40% of our type 2 diabetics have some degree of CKD. So cardiorenal metabolic disease is very common. I think the first thing we need to do is advice about lifestyle. You know, I think alcohol intake, smoking cessation, weight reduction. I think we need to look at things like controlling their blood pressure very well, because we know that poorly controlled blood pressure can lead to renal damage, it can lead to heart failure, it can lead to atrial fibrillation. So that's one of the big things that we need to do. But one thing I think always come back to, and it's been highlighted recently, and I'm one of the principal investigators for a study called the ATTACK study, where we're looking at the use of aspirin or placebo in patients with CKD to prevent CVD. And this is very much where we've been mailing out patients across the country. And it was quite shocking to me that many patients didn't know they had CKD. So I think the first thing we need to do is diagnose it, code it properly, and explain it to patients, because it also has insurance implications for them. Because if they don't declare it to their travel company, it might affect them. So a big plea to please diagnose it, code it, explain it to patients. So I think that's very important. And also look at preventing it or improving it. Let's try and review medications, try and stop truly nephrotoxic drugs like non-steroidals, COX-2 inhibitors, etc., if we don't really need them. Whereas we shouldn't be stopping RASi drugs, so that's ACE, ARBs, mineralocorticoid antagonists, SGLT2s, unless we really need to. So I think it is important that we do that. Diuretics, if they're not really needed, and again, a plea here that so often heart failure patients, we've managed to get them on their full dose of ACE inhibitor, their beta blocker. They may have gone on a mineralocorticoid antagonist, which is spironolactone or eplerenone. They may not need their diuretic anymore. So try to bring them off it. Try and stop drugs that you may not need to avoid getting blood pressure too low, because I do worry with systolics of certainly less than 100, do they really need their amlodipine, their other calcium channel blockers, and all of that may affect renal function. So I think we need to remember all of those first. So to summarize heart failure therapy, Sam, I think what has changed over the past year or two is now we're talking about the four pillars of heart failure management, and we're talking about HFrEF here, because we have no evidence-based outcome data for HFpEF yet. We could discuss empagliflozin. There's been a study recently, but that's out for debate. But they should be on an ACE, an ARB, or sacubitril valsartan, which we call an ARNI, plus a licensed beta blocker. So by licensed, we mean bisoprolol, nebivolol, or carvedilolol, not atenolol or propranolol. Three, a mineralocorticoid antagonist, if they're still symptomatic. So that's spironolactone or eplerenone. Eplerenone is now off patent. It's a lot cheaper. Doesn't cause the estrogenic side effects of gynecomastia at all that spironolactone does. And now we have evidence that the SGLT2s should be the fourth pillar if they're still symptomatic. So dapagliflozin 10 or empagliflozin 10 are now licensed for HFrEF. Empagliflozin doesn't have a nice HTA tag yet, but should get it soon. So they're the drugs we need to go on. Now, you then asked about AKI. So AKI, acute kidney injury, we see a lot of that. And what we need to do is try and avoid it. So we do tell our patients when they're put on any of these RASi drugs, so ACARBs, ARNI, diuretics, MRAs, SGLT2s, metformin, I would add into that as well, that if they develop an intercurrent illness where they're likely to stop eating, stop drinking, have diarrhea or vomiting, so they're going to get dehydrated, they're at a risk of getting AKI. And in those circumstances, we would advise patients to stop any of those drugs I've mentioned temporarily. I would always recommend that they let their clinician know, whether that be their heart failure nurse or their GP or the nurse practitioner, know that they've done that. and stay off these drugs until they're feeling better, until they're back to eating, back to drinking normally. Then they can go back on them at the doses that they were on before. All too often, patients end up in hospital because they haven't done that, or they just got so ill that they couldn't avoid it. And drugs may be stopped temporarily, but they should be restarted again unless advised not to by a specialist.
That's great.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's a really good concise summary of I guess what we'd call sick day rules.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Some people don't like to call it the sick day rules. Now I'm old fashioned and I still do. And we still hand out a little card. We have a little sick day rule card we give to all our patients through the heart failure clinic that I run, so that they know which drugs to stop and for how long. And patient organisations like Pumping Marvellous, the British Heart Foundation, do provide these if you request them as GPs.
Oh, that's really helpful, actually. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, Pumping Marvellous are brilliant at providing this sort of information. Just Google it. I think it's a great name. I was set up by a lovely guy called Nick Hartshorn Evans, who developed heart failure in his 40s. And I actually now sit on their advisory and education board, and we do a lot of patient education and also contribute patients to guideline developments because they should be involved.
So I've got two final questions to ask in regards to CKD. So the first one is, what would you say is the most important thing to remember when managing CKD, if you can choose one?
I'm not sure I can choose one thing. I would say one, diagnose, code, and educate. Okay. Two, look at lifestyle, blood pressure control. They're hugely important. Three, medications reviews to see whether they should be on certain drugs that can make their CKD worse. And four, sick day rules. You know, explain about sick day rules to prevent CKD developing into AKL.
Do you think there'll be any changes in the future to the way we manage CKD or AKI?
Oh, absolutely. This is an area where we're seeing a huge proliferation of trials. So we've now got at least two studies with the SGLT2s, with DAPA, gliflozin, CKD, and Credence with canagliflozin, where we're actually seeing that use of SGLT2s actually improve renal function or at least stop it from getting worse. So you often find when you first start an SGLT2 that EGFR dips, maybe for 2, 3, 4 weeks, rarely up to a couple of months. But then if you look at the graphs in DAPA, CKD, and Credence, renal function improves. So more and more renal physicians, diabetologists, people like myself are putting patients with CKD onto dapagliflozin or canagliflozin. Empagliflozin will also have some data on that soon. I think the other area in CKD is, especially in the combination of heart failure and CKD, we can run into problems with hyperkalemia, so high potassium levels. And that can occur in the context of AKI, which is acute and usually settles. But you do get some groups of patients who have persistent hyperkalemia. And there are now newer agents, calcium, rhizonium type agents that we can use to actually reduce potassium to allow us to get patients on to these RASi drugs that we know have outcome benefits for our patients with heart failure and with CKD. So I think there's a lot of things coming out. I think it is confusing for primary care. I think there's a lot to learn there. So I would encourage, whenever you have the opportunity to access education, like this, of course, aren't we going to say some? But also use advice and guidance. I think COVID, there's been few benefits of COVID to anyone. But I think, one, the IT explosion, I think we're doing a lot more digital, and I think that's a benefit to many patients, despite what some of the papers tell us. But also advice and guidance. You know, I think we for years have had really good advice and guidance from our nephrologists. They were the first people to come up with that. But we can send off an email, and usually within 24 hours, we have advice on what to do with a patient's renal function, their drugs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So if you're unsure, don't be scared to ask for help.
That's great. That's brilliant. And unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. But thank you so much for taking part in our podcast, Amit. It's been really interesting, and I've certainly learned things that I'll be using in my practice. Thank you for listening to the RCGP podcast on heart failure and chronic kidney disease.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's been a pleasure. And I hope, like you, other clinicians find this useful in their practical day-to-day work. Thank you.
Definitely. Thank you so much.